Supersymmetry is an interesting topic about which a lot has written and has been written, and so it's interesting, I think, to get several different takes on this subject, and so that's the purpose of this morning. Here you'll see another one. So we don't know yet what causes electroweak symmetry breaking, and in the past few years there have been a lot of new proposals for this, and extra dimensions, little Higgs, fat Higgs, models without Higgs, etc., etc. But it's remarkable that people, despite all the innovation that goes in here, haven't yet given up on supersymmetry. And I think there are good reasons for that. In fact, supersymmetry is probably the best contender still for a physics, for a theory of physics at the TEV scale. It solves the whole list of problems that one would pose to such a theory. I'll be a little more explicit about that in a moment. And also, it's intrinsically a weak coupling theory, which allows a deep theoretical analysis. For those of you who don't believe in supersymmetry, I will apologize that in this talk I'm going to take supersymmetry extremely seriously, and I'm going to try to look at the parameter space and go quite far into its experimental program. If you're not a fan of supersymmetry, please keep in mind that any reasonable alternative, with some exceptions like global determinism or the anthropic principle, will be at least as complicated. But in supersymmetry, we can at least work out all the details and see what it's necessary to do experimentally. In this lecture, I'll work mainly with the minimal supersymmetric standard model. That's the theory with two Higgs doublets. However, I think there are a number of indications that this model may actually not be complicated enough to explain nature. And I'll pass by this point several times during the course of the lecture. So now, the list of things that the minimal supersymmetric standard model does. And I think the list is very impressive. It solves the hierarchy problem. It gives a way of calculating the Higgs mass, and so it actually explains the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking. And one very attractive thing that you would like to have in a theory of electroweak symmetry breaking is that electroweak symmetry breaking should actually arise because the top quark is heavy, since that's the particle most strongly coupled to the sector that has to give masses to quarks and leptons. And so that actually is a property of supersymmetry. It's consistent with grand unification. It explains the smallness of precision electroweak corrections and flavor-changing neutral current effects, and it gives an origin for cosmic dark matter. And one shouldn't forget that it also gives a direct connection to string theory, which I think here is very important, and also that it gives, at least conceptually, a zero of energy that comes from symmetry. And I feel strongly that this is a prerequisite to solving the problem of the origin of the cosmological constant or dark energy. There's one footnote that you see on this slide, which is that it's more accurate to say that the solutions of all of these problems are accommodated by supersymmetry, hopefully by some natural restrictions on the parameter space. And so I think it's interesting to go and remind ourselves of why these things are true and what the restrictions are. Eventually, these are all clues that will give us our eventual picture of where we are in the space of supersymmetry parameters. It's an interesting study, and so let's begin it. First of all, I'd like to just remind you of the situation with grand unification. Grand unification in supersymmetry is a truly wonderful thing if you're talking to an audience of a physics colloquium. Let me choose the normalization of the U1 that's given by SU5, SO10, or E6. Then, actually, if you use one-looper normalization group equations and ignore thresholds, there's this wonderful equation that the values of electroweak of the three couplings measured at the Z, actually measured experimentally, is this function of the beta function coefficients. And there's essentially a group theory prediction in the MSSM and in the minimal standard model. Experimentally, these numbers are all measured, so you can evaluate it, and it comes out to 0.717 in truly remarkable agreement with this number. And then you can draw these beautiful figures like this one for physics colloquium audiences, which show that you can measure the SU2 and U1 couplings, extrapolate to unification, extrapolate back, and try and predict the value of alpha S. Unfortunately, when you actually make the calculation better by adding TEV scale thresholds and two-loop RGEs, you ruin the very good agreement. Maybe this is not a rigorous inequality, but very typically you find values of alpha S greater than 0.13, whereas the experimental value is something that looks like this. This number we already know quite well, and I think due to the work of this workshop, in 10 years we'll really have this really nailed to below the 1% accuracy. This number we will know very well when we actually measure the SUSY spectrum, because the main uncertainty comes from where the superparticles are. In fact, the lower bound comes from the fact that the superparticles are higher than the LEP2 range. So hopefully 10 years from now, we'll actually know what this difference is to high accuracy. The dream is that that comes from gut scale threshold corrections and might actually be a clue to what the gut theory eventually is.
You don't push it much more than 0.13.
Sorry?
You don't push it much more than 0.13.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, of course, you need to know where the SUSY spectrum is to do this calculation.
Yeah, but there's a parameterized SUSY effective scale. But basically, you can say that you have a lot of the SUSY over an S, and then effective SUSY goes like mu over 6.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this difference can definitely be accommodated by gut scale thresholds.
Yeah, gut scale threshold can change generically, things drastically. But I'm saying we are just talking about TV scale thresholds. Those are very well understood.
Okay. Good. Precision electroweak is another of these subjects that deserves a short comment, although Guido discussed this in great detail on Monday. I have very little to add. There are specific pieces of evidence that argue for a light Higgs. Likelihood functions are multiplicative, so unless you think the experiments are wrong, you probably should take them into account. The most likely explanation is that the Higgs is actually light. I believe that the Higgs was seen at LEP. Purely theorist's opinion. And there is this interesting point that Guido made, that if the SUSY thresholds turn out to be just above the LEP range, you're in a situation where you can generate negative S, which is what you need to actually improve the agreement with the precision electroweak calculations. And Altarelli, Barbieri, and Carvalho's pointed that out some time ago. It's still true. Okay, well now let me introduce the parameters of the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So on this page, I've put only the parameters that are true in the supersymmetric, that is the fundamental part of the Lagrangian. There aren't very many. There are the gauge interactions, which are actually depend only on the standard model gauge couplings, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3. Presumably one parameter, the unified coupling from which they stem. In the superpotential, most of the parameters are the standard model Yukawa couplings. There's one additional parameter, mu, essentially the supersymmetric Higgs mass, which we'll discuss a little more in a moment. And because you have two Higgs doublets in the model, there's this angle of beta or tan beta, which eventually infects all of the predictions and has to be measured to do predictions, precision supersymmetry. However, adding two parameters to the theory is not so bad. The theory then is highly constrained. The problem is that spontaneous supersymmetry breaking is somehow outside of this framework. It has to be added because we know that the selectron is not degenerate with the electron, for example. And once you add it, you then really at this stage can only make a phenomenology of it. So you can write down, for example, the most general set of soft interactions that involve standard model fields. Here I've assumed R parity violation, but still all of the coefficients here in principle could be matrices in flavor with CP violating phases. And if you take that seriously, there are 108 new parameters. But I think the way you have to look at this is that this is a phenomenology describing some theory that we're reaching toward. Really, the goal of experiment is somehow to measure these parameters, as many as possible, to try and figure out what more fundamental theory their origin is their origin. Superpartner mixing can affect the final spectrum, and this is something that will come up in various guises during the talk. The gauginos, the partners of W and Z and photon, can mix with the partners of Higgs, and so as a function of the Higgs mass versus M2, the mass of the SU2 gaugino, one has this kind of level crossing in the spectrum. Out here at large mu, large positive or negative mu, the lightest states are mainly gaugino. For mu relatively small and M2 relatively large, the lightest states are mainly Higgsino. And properties of the spectrum and the predictions change as you move from one region to the other. So part of an experimental program is to figure out where you are in this space. There can also be important effects of left-right mixing among the partners of fermions. Those are parametrized by, for example, for the tau and the top, elements like this. So then the parameter A in the soft Lagrangian can come in, and if it's large, have an important effect. Good. Now, there's not time in this talk for a thorough discussion of the physics of supersymmetry breaking, so let me just content myself by putting a cartoon of that. The parameters with which we're most concerned will be these capital M's, which are the softly generated masses for the scalars, and the little MAs, which are the softly generated masses for the gauginos. A simple model for that is to have some theory at a very high scale with some field which can acquire an expectation value for some F term in supersymmetry. That scale here I call M. It's often called the messenger scale because it's the scale at which the bosons are that send the message of supersymmetry breaking from the ultimate source into the standard model. These coefficients CF and DA will be predicted in models of supersymmetry breaking, and in principle they can depend on what the species is. Then, unfortunately, it's not so simple. Even if you assume that these are universal, you have to convert the parameters at M to parameters at the TEV using the renormalization group evolution. So here, I've put a statement that I actually, it's an oversimplification, but I believe it very strongly. The ultimate goal of experimentation on SUSY particles is to determine M and these parameters that go here, because they are ultimately the clues to this higher energy theory, which is the origin of supersymmetry breaking, but presumably also has more fundamental information. Let me make one, though, caveat about these coefficients C. We know that squarks and sleptons with the same quantum numbers must be in some way kept from mixing with each other in a way that's different from the mixing in the Yukawa structure or the mass matrix, or else they would generate flavor-changing neutral currents. One of the strongest restrictions comes from K long K short, and I've written it here. So basically, you can avoid this restriction by making the down squarks extremely heavy, but if you're not willing to go there, you'd better make the mixing angles very small. Usually the way this is done is to make squarks of the same quantum numbers be very degenerate. And actually in the past few years there are some quite natural ways to do that. Gauge mediation, anomaly mediation, gaugino mediation. There are also schemes where you induce some of the supersymmetry breaking masses by U1D terms, which again can depend only on the gauge quantum numbers and not on what generation you're in. There's some comments on all of these here. This one requires a relatively low mediation scale, so that may be a way of figuring out that it's happening. This one, in the simplest version, has problems with the slepton spectrum, although that can be repaired in various ways, typically by adding some extra gauge symmetry whose D term can get an expectation value. Gaugino mediation has problems in that it tends to give you the lightest tau slepton as the lightest supersymmetric particle, which would give you charged dark matter or some vacuum instability. Schmaltz and Skiba showed that if you have a renormalization group running above the gut scale, you can repair that problem. And then this becomes a very interesting solution for a high scale kind of supersymmetry breaking induction. I should point out that most phenomenological studies are done in the context of the messenger scale at MGUT and these parameters being universal. And so the soft scalar masses are given some universal value M0. The soft Gugino mass is a universal value M1/2. There's really no good reason, though, why these parameters can't depend on the SU2 cross U1 quantum numbers unless you come to some specific model of supersymmetry breaking. And I think ultimately that question is one that we have to address experimentally. So just to give you some kind of figures to show the, first of all, the complexity that you generate even with the simplest assumptions, and then ways that that could be made more complex. Here's a spectrum that's generated just from completely universal conditions at the Planck scale. So you see then that radiative corrections, renormalization group running, would naturally make, let's say, the left-handed sleptons heavier than the right-handed sleptons, would make the squarks heavier than the sleptons, would induce some other splittings in the spectrum that you see here. It's a complicated and interesting spectrum with a lot of targets for experiment. On the next slide, I have some variants of this, basically just the very simplest ones, where, so this is the spectrum on the previous slide. This is one where I've assigned different essentially initial conditions for the renormalization group equation based on what representation of SU5 you're in. Here I've moved the messenger scale down corresponding to mediation not through supergravity but through some lower energy agent, maybe the same thing that gives rise to the axion. And here this is a gauge mediation scenario. In all cases you see the spectrum is perturbed in a way that's characteristic of the specific choice of parameters. Here, for example, the left-handed sleptons are heavier, the right-handed sleptons are heavier than the left-handed sleptons as a result of the initial condition. So the problem for experiment is somehow to measure enough of these masses to see the pattern and sort out what's going on for measurements at this end to extrapolate to the high end. For Gugino's, there's something special to be said about this renormalization group evolution. If you induce supersymmetry breaking masses above the gut scale, it's very natural to think that they come through an operator that looks like this. Here, the gut symmetry invariant. Here, a gut singlet, which can acquire an F term. And that will give universal Gugino masses at the gut scale. And then when you run down to low scales, you get a prediction called Gugino unification, which is to say the three Gugino masses are in the ratio of the coupling constants, which are roughly 0.5 to 1 to 3.5. The simplest models of gauge mediation, for a completely different reason, actually give the same result. And so there's some class of supersymmetry breaking scenarios for which this prediction is actually correct. And I think for that reason, it's very important to test it. Other models can give a qualitatively different spectrum. For example, in anomaly mediation, you find this collection of ratios, essentially a combination of these parameters with the values of the one-loop beta functions. What's odd here is that M1 is actually larger than M2. So the lightest Gugino's are an almost degenerate, there should be tip twiddles on top of that, partners of the charged positive, negative, and neutral W. In the simplest forms of anomaly mediation, this degeneracy is very strict. The splitting is only, I believe, 200 MeV. So effectively, these guys live for a long time and then decay to this one, emitting one pion. And it's a signature that's, in itself, is quite challenging for colliders. Of course, at the LHC, you produce lots of stuff in association with this, and it looks like a big missing energy signal where the products of this guy are lost. In any case, I think it's very important, as we eventually come to the experiments, to measure M1, M2, and M3 independently and try and figure out where you are with respect to the physics that I've written on this slide. Now, the mu parameter, as you remember, is, well, I didn't define it, I'm sorry, on these slides. It's the coefficient in the superpotential of the invariant HdHu. So it's something that gives mass to Higgs bosons in a completely supersymmetric way. It's in some sense paradoxical because it's Suzy invariant, but nevertheless its value to make a reasonable phenomenology has to be that of the Suzy breaking scale. In the MSSM, you can't have mu equals zero because that leaves one neutralino, one of the neutral combinations of gauge and Higgs boson partners, massless. But there are various ways of dealing with that, some of which are experimentally distinguishable. Others are part of the general MSSM phenomenology. Within the MSSM, here are some solutions to this problem. For example, you could add to the superpotential some term with an extra singlet, which gets an expectation value at a very high scale. This might be the thing whose F term is what ultimately breaks supersymmetry at, let's say, 10 to the 11th GeV. But if that process induces a small expectation value for the scalar part of S, then this thing becomes a mu term. Similarly, you could, in the Kähler potential, have a term like this. So now if this guy gets an F term of the kind that would give supersymmetry breaking, then this will turn into something that imitates a part of the superpotential. Another very interesting observation is that if we add singlets to the MSSM, Ann Nelson and her collaborators have suggested this, you can construct a model with mu equals zero that satisfies all the relevant constraints. Essentially, the mixing with the singlets pushes the light neutralinos up above the left bound with reasonable parameters. Here, there's a direct consequence in the spectrum. There are more neutralinos than you would expect in the MSSM. And by sorting out that spectrum, you can tell the difference. In phenomenological studies, mu is usually fixed by the physics of electroweak symmetry breaking. So there's an equation like this, at least at the tree level, which is the minimization of the Higgs potential. So then what one would do is calculate these masses using renormalization group running, fix a value of tan beta, and then you evaluate mu. Very typically in minimal supergravity, these masses turn out to be of the same order of magnitude as the colored states in the theory, the top squark and the gluino, because these masses are strongly renormalized by those parameters in the RGEs. And that leads to a situation where mu is much greater than M1 and M2. So whenever you look at phenomenological studies in supersymmetry, you have to figure out whether you're in effect, this special case of the parameter space. There is a parameter region where this inequality doesn't appear. It's called the focus point. It's an odd feature of the renormalization group equations that if the top quark mass is more or less exactly where it seems to be experimentally, the mass of the up squark can get sucked down into essentially below the TeV, even though these parameters might be multi-TeV, as was pointed out by these people. In any event, there seems to be some kind of reason, some region that people consider natural where mu can be of the same order as these two, and we'll see that appear on some transparencies as we go ahead. The physics of electroweak symmetry breaking also is the thing that gives the qualitative upper limits on the mass scale of Suzy. So a typical equation for, let's say, the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs, restated as a condition for the W mass, might look like this. You see that there are cancellations between, this is now the value of mu and the value of the gluino mass renormalized at at the TEV scale. And so then the argument would be that these things can't be much greater than a TEV, or else you would have several decimal place cancellations to produce MW at 80 GeV. So now let me review a few constraints on the parameter space. First of all, the Higgs mass. Well, Marcel has said a lot about this already. I will say only some very simple things. At lowest order, the Higgs mass, the lighter Higgs mass, satisfies the condition that the Higgs is mz cosine beta, and that's, of course, already excluded at LEP. At the next order, one finds a large radiative correction proportional to m top to the fourth, and so the hope is that this radiative correction would make the MSSM consistent with experiment by raising the value of the Higgs mass. However, one is already in a situation where you need a lot of work from this part of the equation and from further radiative corrections in order to make the theory consistent. To enhance the corrections, you need large Suzy masses, so you make this mass in here large. Or, if you want to abandon universality, you could imagine having a large mass specifically for top and bottom, or turning up the A parameter of top, so you can enhance this with large stop mixing. So I think Marcella may have shown this slide on the previous curve. So as you increase the mixing away from this line, you can have some enhancement in the value of the Higgs mass. I guess for me, I think that if LEP didn't see the Higgs, the phase space left actually is quite small. And for me, this is the most persuasive argument for adding singlets to the MSSM. If you add singlets, you can easily bring the Higgs mass up to about 150 GeV, essentially just by putting in a relatively straightforward potential for those singlets and using them to enhance the expectation value. Okay, beta S gamma. This is very often considered as a constraint on the supersymmetric phase space. The particle data group value has this branching ratio. It's in good agreement with the minimal standard model. The interesting observation is that diagrams both with the charged Higgs in the top quark and with the chargino in the top quark can give contributions to beta S gamma, which first of all are of the same order as this number, and secondly, add coherently with it, so they can have an enhanced effect. One way to get rid of these parameters is to push the supersymmetry spectrum way up, let's say above 500 GeV. But fortunately, there's another way, which is, maybe not so easy to, if you keep your eye on the number 3, or 3.3, that's what you want. And you can see that those numbers come into relatively low values of these Suzy parameters, taking advantage of the fact that when mu is positive, then there can be a destructive interference between the Higgs and the Chargino diagrams. So essentially, one can take advantage of that in a non-universal approach, or in a universal approach, what you have to do is to make the Suzy masses larger than you would otherwise say, in a manner that increases with, in a manner that becomes more stringent as tan beta increases. By the way, I should remind you that there is currently a 3 sigma discrepancy between experiment and the standard model value of the CP phase in this reaction. I guess my own opinion is that this is an experimental discrepancy that's not yet validated by theory. But in another year or so, we may actually have to take this seriously. And what I'm saying is that if you just take what's there at face value, then you calculate this number. As I said, it's not yet validated by theory. Okay. For the mu on G minus 2, I think that should go on this list. There's a new BNL measurement, actually a measurement of mu minus, which nicely checks the previous measurement of the G minus 2 of mu plus. Here's the number. The discrepancy from the standard model is different depending upon how you evaluate, especially the electromagnetic vacuum, the hadronic vacuum polarization correction to G minus 2. You don't have to put errors on these numbers because you can just look at them and see that there's a large systematic theoretical error. In supersymmetry, the value of the correction to alpha mu is something of this order. If the mu parameter is large, or even if it isn't large, certainly if tan beta is large, it's very easy to get numbers that span this entire range. And so what can happen, so this then becomes either an indication for SUSY or a way of excluding SUSY, depending upon what you believe about the reality of this effect, essentially what you believe about the theoretical determination of the hadronic vacuum polarization. There's a very interesting paper by Steve Martin and Jim Wells where they propose an ultra-conservative interpretation of the G-2 result. They only look at the regions that are excluded by 5 sigma, and it's quite strong, actually. It kills off most of the region of negative mu when you have relatively light superparticles. If the effect is real, it favors light sleptons or large tan beta, and here I have some figure that indicates that. So this is the work of Chattopadhyay and Nath. So these are in terms of actually the Chargino and the muon sneutrino masses. And you can see that, so this is for 10, this is for 10, and this is for 40. You can see that there's a robust region of the parameter space that would actually be called for if we can agree on that the effect is there and that it has roughly this value of, let's say, 20 times 10 to the minus 10. Okay. Marcello talked a lot about baryogenesis, so here again I'll make some relatively brief comments. There are different options that are consistent with supersymmetry, and what's very interesting to me is that your option for baryogenesis is hooked into what you believe about the scale of inflation. Probably the most attractive mechanism for baryogenesis now is what's called leptogenesis. You produce a particle-antiparticle asymmetry in the decays of the heavy neutrinos that make the seesaw mechanism that produces neutrino masses. This famously leads to CP violation in the neutrino sector, something that's not as much appreciated but should be, and that was pointed out by Nagiri, and this is Daisuke Nomura, who's now in Durham, that this mechanism leads to observable slepton flavor violation in supersymmetry experiments. Essentially, when you integrate out the heavy neutrino sector, you generate order alpha mixings of the three slepton species in the mass matrix. And so, in principle, if this is right, there'll be very interesting experiments to look for those effects. This mechanism requires a high reheating scale, because otherwise the any asymmetry you generate will be washed out by inflation. If you want inflation at the TEV scale, or a relatively low reheating scale, you'd better go in for weak scale baryogenesis. As Marcella pointed out, this is quite challenging. It occurs only in a relatively restricted region of the MSSM. However, it's a great region. Stops will be found at the tevatron. The electric dipole moment of the electron will be observed in the near future. We'll have tremendous fun exploring the light particles that are implied. And I think it's interesting to keep this in mind. What makes it more interesting for me, just recently... Sorry?
115 is the least
strong. Oh, I'm sorry. You had 118 here. Okay. I'm sorry. This is supposed to be 115 plus a 5 GeV error on the calculation. Excuse me. So what makes it interesting for me is that there's a new paradigm for inflation that I'm now quite excited about by Diwali and Kashru called new old inflation. One of the interesting properties of this paradigm is that you imprint the density fluctuations on the cosmic radiation by mixing of a singlet from the inflation sector with the Higgs field. And this is a very elegant mechanism, so if it's true, it's great, but it means that you have to somehow make this work, either within the MSSM or maybe taking advantage of these singlets that mix with the Higgs to get a little more freedom. And finally, dark matter. Actually, dark matter is a generic property of theories of electroweak symmetry breaking. And this is very well appreciated within our community, but I think out in the popular world, maybe people don't understand this so well. And I think it's important to make a bigger deal of this. There are lots of hypotheses for dark matter. And astrophysicists have a lot of trouble, I think, evaluating which ones are more plausible than which other ones. But for me, I think the most plausible one is that dark matter is a thermal relic defined by these assumptions: an absolutely stable particle, one that, however, that can annihilate in pairs, in thermal equilibrium at early times, and then eventually isolated by the expansion of the universe so that partners can't find each other. In such a theory, one can, in a rather general way, compute the magnitude of the relic density. And so here's a typical equation that you would get. It depends on the current entropy density of the universe, so that depends on the microwave background temperature, on the closure density, so that depends on the Hubble constant, on M. Planck, because it's gravity, and eventually on the thermal annihilation cross-section. So there are numbers in here that involve tens of orders of magnitude, but you can plug them all in and try and get some estimate for the annihilation cross-section. The left-hand side of this equation has just this year been measured extremely accurately by WMAP. And so here's the answer: omega dark matter H squared about 0.1 with about 8% accuracy. And then putting in all the numbers, you find an annihilation cross-section of 1 picobarn, which if you translate that to some kind of parametric form of a weak interaction annihilation cross-section, gives you a mass of 100 GeV. So what does that imply? Well, that implies that LHC will see multi-jets and missing energy at a rate 100 times that of the standard model. And I don't think we should be shy about this. This is maybe now one of the most important motivations for doing the LHC experiments, and in principle for the whole program of TEV physics. And I remind you that the assumption of supersymmetry is not needed for this conclusion. Only the assumption that dark matter was once in thermal equilibrium. Now, when you get into the details of dark matter in SUSY, you end up, however, in a more ambiguous situation. Certainly, this has been very well explored in minimal supergravity, and I'll show you some curves for that case. The problem is that an annihilation cross-section of a picobarn, given the current restrictions on supersymmetry parameter space, is a large cross-section. Well, back in the days when Mark Strednicki invented this theory, 1 picobarn was a very reasonable cross-section because you could make superparticles rather light. Then people thought that omega H squared was about 1 instead of 1/10, and so the whole picture fit together beautifully. But now, actually, we've got to get this number to get omega H squared about 0.1, and that's difficult. And what makes it harder is that what you would think is the dominant annihilation channel, namely annihilation to fermion pairs, is helicity suppressed in the S wave. So basically, you have to go to P wave, and the cross sections are a factor 20 smaller than you thought they would be. So in minimal SUGRA, it's now understood that this prediction occurs only in special regions of the parameter space. Either you can go to the focus point region where the charginos become closer to the neutralinos. That then, using the mixing, you can allow decay to W pairs. That's a nice hefty cross-section. Or you bring sleptons down so that they can be in rough thermal equilibrium with neutralinos, and then these reactions have large cross-section. Or you annihilate in pairs through the A boson, which has to be fortuitously quite close to the neutralino-neutralino threshold. Or, in fact, you can consider bringing one of the top squarks down and doing co-annihilation with the top squark. In any event, here's the kind of results you have for the most recent version of these evaluations by the dark SUSY people. The line we're interested in is omega H squared of 0.1, which is the third line in here. This white region is supposed to be the theoretically allowed constrained minimal supersymmetric model parameter space. And you see that you're really very close to the boundary. This is the region where you get the prediction from basically neutralino annihilation to W pairs. down here from co-annihilation with sleptons, or maybe just with this tau. I have another slide that concentrates more on that bottom corner. So now the black line here is what you would like to obtain. The red lines are the represent the mass splitting of the tau from the lightest neutralino. And so as these masses get pushed up, fortunately maybe the region down here is not so bad, but as those masses get pushed up, you come to smaller and smaller mass splittings. So if you like, when you produce these sleptons, less and less visible energy that you see in experiments. Going outside of the minimal sugra, I think one can relax these conditions, but the situation is generic. I think having 20% mass splittings in the spectrum to get the correct dark matter density is not an unreasonable thing, even in the whole parameter space. Although, mainly I'm just talking off the top of my head, this question needs more investigation. Well, now I've raised many issues about the values of the SUSY parameters. So eventually, all of the questions that I've asked and all of the questions about what parameter region we live in have to be answered by determining the parameters experimentally. So can we actually expect to do this? Well, now let me, in view of the time, make a lightning review of that subject. Is that zero? Oh, gee, okay. Well, we'll see. Okay, so first of all, LHC. I skipped the Tevatron, but Marcella talked about the Tevatron, so that's fine. The dominant reactions for supersymmetry production are these. These should have twiddles on top of them. They typically, as I've shown you, heavy particles, but the lighter SUSY particles appear in their decay chains. The first thing to notice is that the generic SUSY signal is robust. And this is something that Ian has already explained to you earlier in the week. Here's an observable that Ian and Frank Page introduced. And if you look at one of the points that they studied, here are the standard model backgrounds in terms of the value of this observable. Here is the simulation of supersymmetry in the ATLAS detector. Please notice how many orders of magnitude there are on this logarithmic scale. So typically above the value of M effective where you're seeing supersymmetry, you're seeing several order, well, at least two order of magnitude increases of the signal above the background. A very robust signal. Now, once you've seen the signal, we want to do more than that. We want to figure out where we are in the parameter space. And now the situation becomes much less clear. It's clear that you can do something. It's less clear what you can do. ATLAS has worked out a great number of examples of this. And the conclusion is that precision measurements require opportunistic use of special features of the SUSY spectrum in each example. Of course, a gifted experimenter will always find special features that give you the handles on the parameter space. In some sense, that's a tautology. That's what a gifted experimenter is. But nevertheless, let me just give you an example of that. So one thing that happens at several of the points considered by ATLAS is that you make a left-handed squark, which then decays to the second neutralino. This is, if you like, the partner of the Z, which then decays to what would be the partner of the photon plus a lepton pair. The variable which is very interesting here is the mass of the lepton pair which is produced in this decay. So here I've drawn the Dollitz plot for the decay of the N2. In this case, there would be a virtual Z, so you'd populate phase space, although the events do, as I haven't shown here, pile up along this edge where MLL is high. In this case, there's an on-shell slepton, so the events pile up in these two bands in the Dollitz plot. In any event, this is a directly observable variable at the LHC. It's obtained by integrating along that line, and so when you come to the kinematic edge, there's an edge. And let me just show you an example of these. So here is something that came out from the ATLAS simulation of one of the points where this is relevant. If you subtract unlike sign lepton, so you do a background subtraction, then the signal looks like this. This is the Z, which appears in some other cascades. And here you have a relatively sharp edge which indicates the maximum mass and, in fact, also the scenario for N2 going to L plus L minus in the continuum and N1. That was universal boundary conditions. Here's a scenario with non-universal boundary conditions, the same spectrum. You can see that there are actually two relatively sharp edges here, and those correspond to the decay on shell to the, on the one hand, the right-handed, and then here the left-handed sleptons. So in both cases, the mass differences of those things from the light estate can be determined with of order percent accuracy. In cases with on-shell sleptons, there are actually multiple visible upper and lower endpoints, and in fact more constraints than unknown masses. So you can even determine the masses of particles that you haven't observed. Okay. So now I have 2 minutes to talk about the linear collider. And so let me just emphasize ways that the linear collider now improves on this situation, from which we'll already know quite a lot at the LHC. First of all, I remind you that annihilation of E plus E minus to particle pairs is a very simple process. Unlike the LHC, you can actually write down the cross-section, at least at tree level, on one line, and you can see that it depends only on basically the spin of the final products and the electroweak quantum numbers. So by using results like this, by measuring a sine squared theta angular distribution with an absolutely determined normalization, we can make an unambiguous determination of spin and electroweak quantum numbers. For particles that mix, it's very important that this parameter here depends on the electron helicity. So if you look at the cross-section with right-handed and then left-handed polarized electrons, you can determine the mixing angle from the normalization of the cross-section. And that's what's shown in this picture in a study where people, this is the Vienna group, assumed some mixed stop squark observed in first left-handed and then right-handed electron annihilation. The intersection of those two numbers gives you, on the one hand, a check because you should have measured this stop mass from kinematics, and on the other hand, a rather accurate value of the mixing angle. When you start analyzing the final states, it's interesting that when you produce scalars in E plus E minus annihilation, the decay of a scalar is isotropic in its rest frame. If the scalar is produced at a definite energy, which is true in the idealization that there's no initial state radiation, so that's something that you can try and, it's something that's a good first approximation, and then you can systematically correct for it to achieve precision. You boost this isotropic distribution, and it is a flat energy distribution with hard kinematic endpoints. And so, for example, if you know the radiation, which is the thing that rounds the edges of these distributions, you can fit for the kinematic edges. And in this study by the Colorado group, you can determine the slepton masses actually to part per mil precision. The features have to do with the fact that this simulation is done at a point where both the left and right-handed sleptons are produced. And so ideally there is a rectangle here, another rectangle here, and another here, all smeared by initial state radiation and beamstrahlung, but assuming that that's known, one can deconvolve it and come to this part per mil accuracy. By the way, the part per mil accuracy is actually what you need if you're in one of these co-annihilation regions to make an accurate prediction of the cosmological dark matter density. If you don't think you can do it with endpoints, Jonathan Feng and I also looked at selectron production in E minus E minus, and here's an example where the threshold is quite sharp. The difference between these three curves is in each step 100 MeV in the selectron mass, and as you see, it's very cleanly distinguished by this data sample, which I think is only 100 inverse femtobarns. Several reactions involve the charginos and neutralinos in a very explicit way. For example, these reactions are dominated by T-channel neutralino exchange. This one has a very strong beam polarization effect, and the measurement of both of these cross-sections can be used to measure the Gugino-Higgsino mixing. The particularly nice example is to look at this reaction with right-handed electrons. Here's the cross-section. So the black is contour lines of the cross-section in femtobarns. The purple is a curve of constant Chargino mass. And so along that curve, you can see that as you move from the Gaugino region to the Higgsino region, the cross-section changes by two orders of magnitude. And you can just map it out using polarization. Okay, so here is then the conclusion of the talk. I think that given that we have good reason to take SUSY seriously as a theory of the TEV scale, it's worth spending some time thinking through what the issues are for experiment once we get past the discovery of supersymmetry, what we can learn by a more detailed examination of these SUSY particles. I think what we've seen is that really the parameter space is quite complex, and there are a lot of questions to be answered, but that in principle we can have the tools to actually determine the parameters. Well, I think it'll be a lot of fun. I look forward to seeing it. And, well, hopefully we will learn a lot from this era. So, just one more thing. The organizers have asked me to put a wish list of issues for this workshop. And so, basically, from the point of view of theory and specifically for the linear collider, there are three issues. First of all, radiative corrections to the signal processes. I think this is pretty much in hand, and a lot of the results are already done. Radiative corrections to background processes is a more subtle business, because the problem is understanding the tails of distributions, where you radiate one or more photons in these reactions. So we're not quite there yet. And also, some precision, and here I mean NNLO and electroweak theory, calculations of these two processes are needed for the absolute and differential luminosity measurements. And so that's an interesting thing if someone has methods to really explore these properties deeply. I remind you that there is a residual uncertainty in the normalization of the peak of the Z, which basically comes from the fact, from the limitation of the theoretical understanding of small angle Baba scattering. So for the linear collider, we've got to do better. And that means part per mil over a quite large angular region near forward. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to tell you. Thank you very much. Please. Tell me when I got there.
There we go.
Oh, this one?
Right. Or,
yes.
I think I've never understood what it is. It's actually getting shown here. First of all, what are the error bars?
Okay, so the error bars are, take 100 inverse femtobarns, divided among points in a hopefully optimal way. Actually, I think we may have just divided it among points, divided it equally among these points. And that's supposed to be the statistical error on the cross-section, given what the value of the cross-section is for the solid line.
Well, I simply don't believe that, because that means that in the lowest point there, you've got three events.
Yes.
I just don't understand that.
But this is E minus E minus. The backgrounds really are that small.
It doesn't matter. Three events. You can't perform any kind of a fit to it and expect the error to be that small.
Well, I remind you that the Beijing detector determined the tau mass to four significant the tau mass to four significant figures with about five events total. You just had to put them in the right place. Okay.
Okay, let's thank the speakers just now. Coffee break.